directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
This May 21st, supporters gathered outside the Winnipeg Remand Center to remember and honor the lives of airline.
The circus ride is 24/7, all year round, and it's worth the attraction.
Good morning. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is the Prison Radio Show, and my name is Candace, and I'm going to be your host for today's show. Today, we'll be hearing from Matt Cicero, an organizer in Ottawa who was arrested in 2010 in connection with the firebombing of a Royal Bank of Canada in the aftermath of the Vancouver Olympics and in the lead-up to the G8 G20 meeting in Toronto. This interview comes in the wake of news about the death of Roger Clement, who was arrested and charged with firebombing the RBC in 2010. Our show will feature both the eulogy for Roger, written and read by Matt, and an interview with Matt about the circumstances surrounding his and Roger's arrests. But first, a few news items. According to supportprisonerresistance.noblogs.org, a Free Alabama Movement organizer is being targeted and tortured. James Dati Khalid Pleasant was arbitrarily transferred this week from St. Clair Population to Donaldson Correctional Facility and placed in a hot bay strip segregation unit. A hot bay or strip cell, also known as a suicide cell, is a special unit often used to deprive prisoners of the most basic necessities on the pretext that they may harm themselves. The stripped cell has no bed or furniture. Prisoners are confined there and are denied all property, including clothing. The temperature is kept low, and the lights are on constantly. Prison administrators claim these cells are for mental health observation, but the conditions of isolation and sleep deprivation tend to actually exacerbate mental health crises. James Dati Khalid Pleasant was robbed of all of his personal belongings, sprayed with a chemical agent, and then placed in a shower stall the remainder of the night. He's being targeted for his role as an organizer of the Free Alabama Movement. Support Prisoner Resistance is calling on outside supporters to phone the Donaldson Correctional Facility now and demand Pleasant's release from Hot Bay. The Donaldson Prison Warden, Leon Bowling, can be reached at 205-436-3681. Again, that's 205-436-3681. And as we reported during the last episode of the Prison Radio Show, June 11th marked the International Day of Solidarity with Marius Mason and all long-term anarchist prisoners. In Washington, D.C., there was a convergence to fight toxic prisons and support eco-prisoners held over the course of 3 days. The focus of the convergence was to organize resistance at the intersection of mass incarceration and the environment. After 2 days of networking, strategizing, and listening to the wisdom of Black liberation fighters like Ramona Africa and Jihad Abdul-Mumit, as well as former eco-prisoners like Eric McDavid and Daniel McGowan, the Convergence marched on June 13th on the United States Federal Bureau of Prisons. According to DC Direct Action News, the Fight Toxic Prisons march of approximately 50 people blockaded the streets in front of the Bureau of Prisons, the FBI, and the Department of Justice, holding back rush hour traffic for 1 hour. Demands centered around stopping the proposed construction of two new Supermax prisons, one in Letcher, Kentucky, and the other in Thompson, Illinois. The proposed prison site in Kentucky is a mountaintop removal site for coal mining, and the proposed construction of a new prison in Illinois would be on a Superfund site. that is, a toxic waste dump of the U.S. military. Further demands included the release of all prisoners and closure of every prison on the continent. Many times during the march, chants and songs called for the burning of prisons, not coal, as well as break the locks, no more cops. We are now going to hear Mumia Abu-Jamal's latest, Solitary, Arthur's World.
Solitary, Arthur's World. His name is Arthur Johnson, and he has lived in his cell, in the hole, for 37 years. You heard me right. 37 years. He was first cast into the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections version of hell, officially known as solitary confinement, in December 1979. Jimmy Carter was president. The Shah of Iran had just been overthrown by the Islamic Revolution. Tennis star John McEnroe won his first U.S. Open championship. Muhammad Ali wasn't just alive. He had recently retired from the boxing ring. From that time to this very day, Arthur Johnson has been in continuous solitary confinement, locked in the hole and virtually forgotten until now. Recently, the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, filed an Eighth Amendment challenge to Johnson's continuous solitary confinement and seeks an injunction in federal court. For 37 years, Johnson has lived in the hole, held in a 7 by 12 feet cell, held 23 hours a day, an hour is allowed, in an outdoor cage, for an alleged attempted escape in 1979. Facing conditions such as these, the question arises, who wouldn't want to escape? For 37 years, he hasn't touched a woman's hand, held a child in his arms, hugged a relative, or entered a classroom, prayed in a religious congregation, or walked more than 10 feet without being handcuffed or shackled. He's lived in, if you can call this living, nearly a dozen prisons: Forest, Huntington, Smithfield, Graterford, Greene, back to Huntington, but always only in the hole, never in general population. Never free of handcuffs, chains, and shackles. When he came to prison, he was 18. He's 63 now. That's the face of Pennsylvania corrections. That's the reality of solitary confinement, the hole. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Next here on Prison Radio, we are going to hear from Groundwire Community Radio News. Here is CKUW's Stefan Doucette reporting on the death of Bradley Errol Green at the Winnipeg Remand Center after he was denied access to epilepsy medication.
This May 21st, supporters gathered outside the Winnipeg Remand Center to remember and honor the lives of Errol Green and Holly Hall, as well as others who've died in the custody of jails in this country. Both Green and Hall died preventable deaths due to a lack of medical care while being detained at the remand center. Errol Green died on May 1st after suffering two epileptic seizures after being denied his medication for the 3 days since he was arrested and incarcerated. He was 26, a father of three with another on the way, and is loved and missed by many. He should still be here. Holly Hall died on March 17th from what authorities are calling influenza or a flu-like illness. There are few details as to how her illness was allowed to get so bad as to kill her. She was 38, a loving mother, and is loved and missed by many. She should still be here. One of the co-organizers of the event, Cecil James, spoke out.
This is all sunny now. This is a lot more widespread than we had to think. We have the far to left. My sister died of a heart attack in the Regional Psychiatric Center in Saskatoon in January 2013. And we didn't have the means to go up and travel to Saskatoon and do rallies like this. So I became aware of Holly, and I became aware of I wanted to do something. I wanted to take a lead and try and do something because
On June 4th, 2 weeks after the demonstration, I had the chance to speak with Errol Green's wife, Rochelle Pranteau, about her husband and the circumstances surrounding his death.
What I wanted Errol to be remembered is he was a great, loving man. He was a family person. Family meant everything to him. He was funny, caring, generous. He was really nice when you actually got to know him. Wasn't really popular, but he still had friends. Because his main focus was his family.
So what was the response that you wish the Remand Center or the province or the MGEU had offered after the death of your husband?
Well, there's nothing that they could really do. They should have just gave him his meds. And that's like the main thing right there. So there's not much that I can really say that I wish.
And their response so far has been just pure silence? They have not shared anything with you?
No, they haven't told me nothing.
And what's been the reaction of other people who were inside the Remand Center at the time of Errol's passing, like other inmates?
They said it was a wrongful death. They were shocked with how they treated him and how they were, like, trying to cover it up.
And what are you hoping for the future in Errol's case, or more generally for people who are incarcerated and access to medication and access to proper treatment?
Things need to change because it's important. It doesn't matter like what kind of meds, like if they need the medical, they need it. Shouldn't neglect them, especially when it comes with life and death. And it could have been prevented if they did the right thing by calling 911 right away. When justice needs to be served, and what they're doing is covering it up and not telling me my answers is just wrong.
The Manitoba General Employees Union, or MGEU, put out a statement on May 12th asking for, quote, everyone to withhold judgment on what happened until all the facts are known, unquote. That would be a fair statement if prisons were not amongst the most secretive institutions known for rampant covering up of their own abuses. When asked to explain this demand for withholding judgment, MGEU staff claimed to be privy to information which sheds a different light on Errol's death. However, they've not shared this information with those who need it most, namely his wife and family. The testimonies of many inmates corroborate the story told so far of extreme negligence and complicity in Errol's death. The MGEU needs to either share this information with Errol's family or stop defending prison guards responsible for his death. There's lots more to do to bring some form of justice and peace for Errol Green's family, Holly Hall's family, those still behind bars, and their loved ones on the outside. This is Stéphane Doucette from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 Territory, traditional territory of the Nahiwak and Nakota, and homeland of the Métis Nation.
And that was a segment produced by CKUW from Groundwire Community Radio News. You are listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable and online at CKUT.ca. The time is presently 11:14. Stay tuned because next on the show we are going to be hearing a eulogy for Roger Clement as well as an interview with Matt Cicero in Ottawa about a firebombing that took place of the RBC Bank in Ottawa in 2010.
A month against borders. Solidarity Across Borders and Allies are organizing actions throughout the month of June to denounce the violence, racism, and oppression of border controls and their daily impact on tens of thousands of people in Montreal. Join us as we amplify our voices with public art projects, demonstrations, community meals, and a variety of activities in resistance to colonial borders and deportations. Events include June 4th, Borders Are Bonkers Theater Action, Open the Borders Block Party and Demo, June 11th, Picnic and Anti-Racist Soccer Tournament, June 24th and 25th, Barbecue Party and Mural Painting, plus workshops, film screenings, and more. For more information, please check out solidarityacrossborders.org, A Month Against Deportations, a CKT co-presentation.
Up next is a eulogy for Roger Clement, written by Matt Cicero in Ottawa.
On Tuesday, June 7th, Roger Clement died in Cuba of a brain aneurysm. He was 64. Roger Clement became famous after he was arrested and charged for the arson of a Royal Bank of Canada on May 18th, 2010. Two other men were arrested for the arson on the same day, although only one would be formally charged with arson by the police. Roger pled guilty on November 9, 2010, to one count of arson to property for the May 18th action and one count of mischief to property over $5,000 for a separate action. One of his conditions for pleading guilty was that the Crown stay their charges against his co-defendant, Matthew Morgan Brown. In December of 2011, the Crown dropped the charges against Mr. Morgan Brown due to a lack of evidence against him. On December 7, 2010, Roger Clement was sentenced to 4 years in prison. The judge gave him 3.5 years for the arson and 6 months for the mischief charge. He served two-thirds of his sentence, as is common in the Canadian prison system. The manifesto that the group FFFC Ottawa put out following the arson highlighted anti-capitalist and anti-colonial resistance to the Olympics that had taken place in Vancouver in February. The manifesto also drew attention to the June 2010 G8 G20 summit and opposed leaders and bankers' policies of exploitation of people and the environment. The manifesto drew attention to the occupation of British Columbia by the Canadian government for the benefit of its corporate masters and to the detriment of Aboriginal peoples, workers, and the poor of the province. It also focused on environmental destruction caused by the Olympics and the tar sands. The Royal Bank of Canada heavily finances the tar sands industry. While he is best known for his role in the firebombing, Roger was a lifelong activist, an ardent communist, and a Cuban patriot. He was well loved by many, and he will be deeply missed.
Now we will hear an interview with Matt in Virginia. The interview took place in Ottawa, and in ceded Algonquin territory on June 18, 2016. Which was the 6-year anniversary of Matt's arrest in connection with the firebombing of the RBC Bank in Ottawa.
My name is Matt Cicero. I was arrested when I was using the name Matt Morgan Brown. I'm from Ottawa, and I was arrested on June 18th, 6 years ago today, in 2010, and eventually charged with arson against RBC branch in Ottawa. The charges were stayed and then dropped due to a lack of evidence.
So let's start the story maybe with the RBC bombing itself. Do you remember the date when people found out that the RBC branch had been bombed? I know there was a video that came out shortly afterwards that was kind of like a political explanation of why people had done the arson on the RBC bank.
I don't remember when the video came out, but I do remember, it was May 18th, 2010, 1 month before.
Okay. And this was all happening in the context of the Vancouver Olympics were happening that year. There was also the G20 in Toronto, which was about to happen in June of that year. Do you want to talk a little bit about the lead up to your arrest? So the bombing happened May 18th, and then you were arrested exactly a month later.
Yeah, so a lot of people in Ottawa were a little nervous. I certainly was from time to time. It didn't seem that different. Certainly people were more nervous. I mean, one of the things that happened was that this undercover police officer whose real name was Denis Leduc, the name he was going under was François Leclerc, was around all the time. Wherever we'd go, he'd show up. He was asking all sorts of questions, talking. He was talking with one guy about guns. He was talking. At one point, he asked me if I wanted to fly up to Nunavut. We were all very suspicious of him. That was the sort of the weirdest thing that was going on was his behavior.
So you got arrested on June 18th, 2010. And then I assume you got to talk to a lawyer and you found out what your charges were. Do you want to talk a little bit about what your charges were and how it felt to figure out what you were being charged with in connection to the RBC bombing?
So when I was arrested, I was told that I was being charged with arson. I was walking to work. I worked at Oberg, Ottawa at the time. I was walking to the bus station and some plainclothes officers stopped me at the corner and told me I was under arrest for arson. And then they took me, or a uniformed officer showed up, and they put me in the back of the car, and they took me about a block away and read me my rights. And then we drove down to the police station. I said I wanted to talk to a lawyer. They drove me down to the police station and threw me in the holding cell. And then I got to, I finally got to talk to a lawyer, my lawyer, Ian Brown. And at that time, they were talking, they were throwing around the, you know, arson was one thing, but they were also talking about charging us with terrorism. And arson comes with a maximum of 14 years, or arson of property comes with a maximum of 14 years. Terrorism comes with a maximum of a life sentence.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how it felt to hear that you might be facing terrorism charges? I think that happened. A lot of people ended up facing a lot of heavy, potentially heavy charges that summer, and it seemed like it was a pretty hard thing for a lot of people to deal with. So
it was scary. I mean, 14 years was scary enough, but yeah. The idea of 25 years on top of that was, you know, I was thinking the worst case scenario was, you know, that's a long time to spend in prison.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what they were going to, like I said, they had no evidence, but that when I was in the holding cell, when I was in jail, you know, I was still worried.
So you were in the holding cell for a while, and then you get transferred to Innis Jail. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it was like initially when you were in Innis?
Being transferred to Innis was actually, you know, at first it was better. The holding cells in Ottawa, I'm guessing holding cells in pretty much all police stations are way too cold. The place where you have to sleep is a metal bunk. It's not at all comfortable. It's really cold. There's always people screaming. People are coming in drunk and with all the different problems, screaming. It's noisy. They keep people cold. You know, they'll take their clothes away. So being transferred to Innis at first was good. I mean, me, Roger, and the other guy. I say the other guy because he doesn't want his name in the media. We're all taken to Innis, and that was the first time we got to talk to each other and see each other, so that was good, you know. And we got some good food. All they have at the holding centers is cheeses and ham sandwiches, and a blanket, so I was warmer. And then they put me in segregation. And Roger and I didn't know what had happened to them. I didn't have my glasses. They took my glasses away, so I didn't have contact lenses. I didn't have glasses, and I really can't see very well. There was seg, so there was nothing to do. I didn't have any money to get any canteen. I didn't know how anything worked in the prison, and they weren't giving me my medication. So for about 3 days, those 3 or 4 days before I started to get my meds again, were some really, really fucking rough days. I had a 4 day anxiety attack. That was traumatizing. It was as bad as not the worst thing that I've ever, you know, not the worst amount of fear and anxiety that I've experienced in my life, but it's up there in the top 5, top 10. Mm-hmm. It was really, really bad. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, I certainly felt at the time like it was intentional. They focused on me. They put me in seg. They took my medication away. But it's also true that a lot of people in prison, in detention centers, will not be given their medications.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your relationship with Roger? Did you know him before you guys ended up sharing a cell? Were you guys around the same political scenes in Ottawa? What was your relationship like before you both got arrested in connection to the RBC bombing?
I knew Roger a bit before the bombing. We weren't really close. It was actually the arrest and all of that really kind of brought us together. Roger was a communist, but for the most part, he hung out with a lot of anarchists anyways. I am part of the anarchist and radical left community in Ottawa. So I knew him from, I seen him at parties. I hung out with him a little bit.
So you are thrown in segregation and they take away your meds, and that sounds like it was a pretty rough ordeal, and you end up getting reunited with Roger and your other co-accused?
Yeah. So we got put together in medical isolation for one night, which was amazing. I don't know how, you know, sometimes I think of it as some kind of a minor miracle. I don't know, you know, what the authorities were thinking. I don't know if somebody was thinking we were going to fight with each other, or if somebody was just, it was an act of kindness, or maybe they just didn't know what to do. But they put us all in a room together, and I'd gotten some of my meds the night before, so I was starting to feel a little bit better. And being able to spend the night with two people that I knew was really, really good. And they were, compared to me, they had things relatively easy. They had access to the canteen, so they had a chessboard. They had some things to do. They had some pencils. They had it was nice to go from where I was, which was alone with nothing, basically nothing to do, surrounded by people that I didn't know. To being with two friends and having something to do.
Mm-hmm. And eventually it was just you and Roger sharing a cell together, and your other co-accused was transferred elsewhere?
So we got that one night. The next day the warden showed up and said, what the fuck are these three guys doing in a cell together? And we were transferred. We were separated. They threw me and Roger in one range and in the other. We were in a cell. So for me and Roger, that was not too bad. It was probably a little hard. He got bail a few days later. So, and me and Roger both had to stay at it. Roger never got bail. I got bail 5 weeks later.
So. At this point, you and Roger were sharing a cell in Innes, and you ended up sharing a cell for 5 weeks. I know there was a bit of, like, moving around to different places for you, at least, at the end there. But how long were you and Roger sharing a cell together for?
It was a week, maybe 10 days. Roger went up for bail, 7 to 10 days later, and he was denied. He came back with conditions not to communicate with me, and after that, he was transferred away. Hmm. And I didn't get to talk to him again. I didn't actually get to talk to him in person until he was out.
So to focus on the rest of your story here, you ended up having other charges in Quebec that you were dealing with at the same time as these RBC charges came up. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it was like getting transferred back and forth between Quebec and Ontario, and how dealing with those charges played out?
Yeah. First, I want to say that one of the things on the range where we were was it was about half neo-Nazis, which was not really too good for us. Neither of us, obviously. Roger, a communist, me, an anarchist, are down with neo-Nazis or down with white supremacy. Fortunately, they didn't seem to really know too much about politics or to be too, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of neo-Nazis who are really anti-communist. And I'd, you know, read about in Seattle, I think, or maybe it was Portland, neo-Nazis had killed an anarchist, anti-racist. So, you know, we were both understandably a little nervous about that. And the other half at that time was about half Native and half neo-Nazis and skinheads. But they seemed to be more interested in drugs and they seemed to be more street guys who had some kind of white supremacist politics, but not really like hardcore political neo-Nazis. That was my impression. Yeah, so I had charges in Maniwaki. I'd been sentenced. I was supposed to get, I forget what it was. It was like suspended sentence.
Okay.
I think it was a suspended sentence. And then I got arrested, although the charges were dropped, and they put me, they hadn't sentenced me yet, so they decided to sentence me again. They gave me a harsher sentence because I'd been arrested, although I hadn't been charged with anything, which is one of the things, you know, the whole presumption of innocence disappears as soon as you get arrested. As soon as you get arrested, especially if you're in prison, if you're inside and you can't get bail, so for people who are poor or for various reasons the courts won't let out, the presumption of innocence is really pretty much theoretical. It doesn't exist very much on a practical level. So they gave me a harsher charge, which, I mean, it was 10 days, I think. It still wasn't a huge amount. But I hadn't actually been convicted of anything. But because I'd even been arrested, they gave me a harsher charge. After that, I was transferred back. So I went up to Maniwaki. I was there for one night or for the day, I think, even. And then brought back to... I was in Gatineau for one night, and then up to Maniwaki, then back to Gatineau for another night, and then over back to Innis. And then after that, my lawyer had been waiting to deal with that because he figured that the JP would want that resolved before dealing with bail. Also, he wanted to wait. At that point, it had been 5 weeks since the firebombing and the G8-G20 had happened, and a lot of shit had gone down at G8-G20. You know, I was really happy to see everybody burning the cop cars, and people in the prison for the most part were sympathetic. They definitely thought that cop cars being burnt and fighting with cops was interesting. I don't know if they all thought it was a good thing. You know, people weren't all that political. They also thought that burning down a bank was pretty cool. That was one of the things we had going for us, that we were in on a good charge. The only thing I ever heard anybody say against it was that instead of burning it down, you know, I'm not saying they said that whoever did it should have robbed the bank, not burnt it down. All that to say that a long time had passed, 5 weeks. There was a lot less, the media wasn't as focused on the case at that point as it had been. And I went up to the JP, and the JP looked at the evidence and said, "There's basically no evidence against you. I'm gonna give you a $5,000 bond, and you're done. Boom." And that was way, way less money. We'd raised, potentially quite a lot more than that. So it was a happy surprise, and I hear the JP say that. And then because I had the charges in Maniwaki, I didn't get out right then. They took me over to Gatineau, and I did 7 days in the Gatineau prison.
Mm-hmm. So overall, how much time did you end up serving in the context of the arrest for the RBC bombing plus these charges in Maniwaki?
I was at Innis for about 5 weeks, and I was at Gatineau for a week. So I did a week of – I did my sentence for the blockade of Highway 117. That's what I was charged with in Quebec. The charge at Innis, it was dead time. Mm-hmm. They never went to trial. Mm-hmm. I was never convicted of anything. It was just 5 weeks of my life that they took away.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what kind of – if you got any, what kind of outside support you were receiving for those 5 weeks that you were in Innis and the 1 week that you were in Gatineau?
Yeah, there was a lot of people who were supportive. A group of Ottawa activists created the Ottawa Movement Defense, who helped with me and Roger and the other guy taking our statements. Basically, at the time, to a large extent, because of what our lawyers were saying, we really didn't say anything to the media. We just wanted our strategy was to get the story out of the media, get it away from to depoliticize it as much as possible, in order to get out to give ourselves the best chance in the courts, and I think that worked actually. The negative side was that we couldn't draw attention to the action. I support the action. I've always said that I supported the action. And it meant, really sort of downplaying support for the action, downplaying support for militant direct action for a while.
And let's bring this back to Roger's part in this whole story, because one of the reasons why you contacted me about doing this interview is that Roger passed away in early June. And so Let's talk a little bit more about him and what his experience was like. I know he ended up serving a bunch of time on these charges. Do you want to talk about, did he go to trial? What kind of sentence did he end up with? How did that go down for him?
So Roger eventually pled guilty. As part of his agreement for pleading guilty, he insisted that the Crown drop their charges against me. They stayed the charges, and then eventually they did drop them. He pled guilty to two things. One was to the arson against the RBC, but the other was to mischief over $5,000 for another action against a different RBC. He was sentenced to 4 years in total, 3.5 for the arson, 6 months for the mischief to property over $5,000. He did his time in Pittsburgh against the Pittsburgh Institution minimum in Kingston. He did 2/3 of it. And because of the way things were done right then, he didn't get 2-for-1 for his time. I don't think he got any extra time for his time at Innes, even though my time there, we were triple bunked. We were double bunked. I mean, double bunking was just, that's how it was. We were triple bunked some of the time. It was overcrowded. And I know Roger was in similar circumstances. Now he would get at least 1.5 times. He did 2/3, which ends up being, I forget exactly, 300 days or something like that. No, more than 600 days. You could find it online. I didn't have any ID, so I never went and visited him. I did write to him. Wrote to him, once a month, something like that. He said he told me afterwards he wished I'd written more. I tried to get him to talk about it because I know it was something that hurt him, that he was traumatized about. I know that he wrote a little bit about it, and I was trying to get him to write about it for therapeutic reasons, even if he didn't do anything with it. He was resistant to that, so I know it was a really bad, hard time for him. The time we were in the cell together, he was really suffering at that point in time. He was really going through a lot of anxiety himself. Although I think that evened out, it was definitely a really hard time. I have no doubt that it negatively affected his mental and physical health. I mean, it was a traumatic experience. And then for most people in prison, you know, the food, it's really hard to take care of one's physical health. So I definitely think that it contributed to some extent to his death. He was only 64. I mean, he'd had two heart attacks. Certainly, you know, he'd smoked heavily for 30 years. It's not like all the damage is just about what happened in prison, but it certainly didn't help.
So Roger got out about 600 days after he got sentenced, and you two finally got to see each other again face-to-face. Did he stick around in Ottawa for a while after he got out? I know when he died, he was in Cuba, but was he living in Ottawa before that?
He was visiting Cuba. He was still living in Ottawa. Yeah, he loved Cuba. I mean, that was one of when I was getting to know him after he got out, and even before, one of the things he would always tell me about Cuba, tell me what was good about Cuba, what's Cuba, in Cuba this is good, in Cuba that's good, things are good in Cuba, talk about socialism and the fact that things there work a lot better than they do in Canada or the U.S. or a lot of other countries. He was really a Cuban patriot, as a Canadian citizen, but a Cuban patriot. And he'd been working with Friends of Cuba or the Ottawa Cuba Connection for decades. I don't know exactly how long, but for a long time. Whenever he went down to Cuba, he'd take medical supplies. He'd go down to Cuba and he'd spend his money there. He did whatever he could to help Cuba. He really loved it there. He was just going down for 2 months. He'd been there for 6 months previously. He was trying to get married. He had a plan to marry a Cuban citizen, so that he could become a Cuban citizen and live in Cuba. And sadly, he died in Cuba.
Can you talk a bit about how the RBC bombing and the subsequent arrests, and I'm sure also like the effect of having found out that there was a cop in the scene, how all of those things affected the, whatever we want to call it, the radical left, the anarchist scene, whatever, in Ottawa? Like, did it have an impact on the kind of organizing that was happening here? It definitely sounds like it had an impact on individual people in Ottawa. But maybe if you want to try and talk about it on like a broader community level, that would be great.
I haven't had a lot of conversations with people about it, so it's hard to say in some ways. Definitely, I know that there was a lot of fear and panic for a while. Then there was this wasn't like internal to the radical left, but there was always the conflicts between people who are into ideologically support nonviolence, who think that, and you know, the RBC firebombing was a nonviolent action, but people who even see damage of property as violence, and people who seem to think any kind of militant direct action, whether it's violent or nonviolent, is violence. Or it's almost like any action that they don't agree with is violence. And I don't know. That doesn't seem very. I don't find their arguments to be very logical. So definitely, those sort of conflicts were accentuated. That's not purely a bad thing. It's useful to know who's positioned where. It's not clear to me exactly how it impacted people in the long term. I know for me. It really, one of the things that it brought home was the reality that if and when the Canadian state decides to repress the radical left and the anarchist movement, it's going to be really, what we've experienced so far is pretty mild repression. And we need to be ready for much, much more serious repression. If I was a Muslim, if Roger was a Muslim, I think they probably would attack on terrorism charges. Yeah, they would. I mean, you know, what they got from Roger was 4 years. It wasn't what they wanted. They wanted to put us all in jail for a long time. I'm sure they wanted to put other people in jail for a long time too. And we have to be ready for that. I know, you know, one of the things that I've, for example, one of the things I've done is. I'm trying to get off those medications so that if I go to prison again, I won't have the problem where they can deny me my medication. They're not going to play by Canadian law. They're not going to respect people's civil rights. When they come down on people, a lot or most of the protections get ignored. Maybe afterwards, you know, after the if the case gets press attention or gets the attention of some powerful people. They'll have to start. They start having to, because of the optics of the thing, have to start respecting civil rights and human rights. But they'll ignore those if and when they want to. And we need to be aware of that. Another big thing for me, and it's not about inside the radical left, was being in prison, and a lot of people there are people who experience a lot of oppression. I was periodically trying to think about anti-oppression and how that would work and for people who experience pretty brutal oppression on a regular basis. But certainly, you know, they wouldn't find any of the, like, you know, anti-oppression comes, the anti-oppression I've been exposed to for the most part comes out of universities, comes from people who are university educated. It has value. That's why I'm bringing it up. I think it's important that we be able to do it effectively. And the language that I've been taught around it, I didn't think it was really going to work very well talking with these guys. So we need to, as a movement, we need to think about how to, and I think that's a class thing. I mean, it's a bunch of things, but partly it's a class thing. And we need to figure out how to talk effectively about oppression in ways that people who aren't university educated, in ways that people who aren't part of a small group of people who know the correct language, can identify and is it accessible to people? And it's really, really important if we want to be, and we have to be effective, a broad-based working class movement. I mean, I'll say this. I know one of the things that Roger said this to me. So one of the things Roger was disappointed that after he burnt down the RBC, that there wasn't a series of actions cross country targeting the RBC, where a lot of people attacked the RBC, burned down RBC branches. I know that was one of the things that he was disappointed about. So I want to say, you know, that people need to be strategic about what they're doing, and they need to think things through. But Roger would certainly have approved of you know, there's the Canada's 150th birthday is an opportunity for actions, militant direct actions to attack Canadian nationalism and settler colonialism. And I really want to emphasize the value and the need for militant direct action from the radical left.
That's it for my questions. Do you feel like there's any parts of the story that got left out or anything you wanted to add?
There is one thing I wanted to add, which is that I write a blog. The blog is called Stones and Sticks and Words. It's at stonesandsticksandwords.wordpress.com, and I'm going to be writing a blog post today, and I'm going to be writing for the next 5 weeks or so, 6 weeks, basically paralleling the period of time that I was incarcerated, and I'm going to be talking about the experiences that I have. So I'd really invite anybody who hears this to check out my blog. Again, that's Stones and Sticks and Words, and hopefully you'll read what I write and enjoy it.
Cool. Thanks so much for letting me do this interview, Matt.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Matt, who was arrested in connection with the firebombing of an RBC branch in Ottawa in 2010. Matt was arrested with Roger Clement, who passed away on June 6, 2016, at the age of 64. Roger served time in a federal penitentiary for carrying out the firebombing of the bank and remained an ardent communist until his death. Rest in peace, Roger. You are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CQUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at CQUT.ca. The time is presently 11:48. We are going to hear a song called Apology by Astrid Otto. Then stay tuned. We are going to be hearing a short bit from a Baltimore press conference from Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're also going to hear from Kalfani Malik Khaldun, who reads and comments on Affirmation by Asada Shakur. This is the Prison Radio Show on CQUT.
Today, while this cop, the one who administered the rough ride, is on trial. Because look, what happened to Freddie Gray was murder, plain and simple. That's all it was. That's what it was. No other description. Freddie Gray was plenty healthy when he encountered those cops. But after he encountered them, after they beat him down, after they threw him bent like a pretzel in that police van, after they gave him a rough ride, his spine was nearly broke, and those injuries led to his death. In the old days, it would have been a racist white lynch mob doing a black man like that. Well, today, it's police officers, individually or in groups, who do that and who get away with it. And this has to stop. And look, it ain't just the cops. It's the whole criminal injustice system. The DAs who refuse to charge the cops. The courts who won't convict them while they continue to send black people and brown people into prison. That is what we're up against, and it's a statement from this system that black life does not matter. Black life mattered when they could enslave black people on the plantation and work them for nothing and make profit that way. Black life mattered when they could work us in the factories at the bottom level jobs. They got nothing for these young black people out here today. No jobs. A broke education system. What they got for them is cops, courts, prisons, and early grades. And it ain't a question of which individual cop or which individual DA. It's a question of a system. And look, I'm Carl Dix. I've been involved in this struggle for a long time. I'm also a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and I co-founded the Stop Mass Incarceration Network with Dr. Cornel West. But I'm going to tell you where I'm coming from. And where I'm coming from is that this horror is built into the fabric of this capitalist imperialist system. It's how the system works. And unless and until we make revolution and get rid of this system, these horrors are going to keep going. We're going to have poison water pumped into the homes of black people in Flint, Michigan, and other cities around the country. That's what we're going to have, and that's what's going on. And look, we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are organizing right now for an actual revolution to get rid of this system at the soonest possible time and bring a totally different and far better system into being. We got the leadership for this in terms of Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who has said the role of the police is not to serve and protect the people, but to serve and protect the system that rules over the people.
Right, say that again.
Look, and a crucial part of organizing this revolution is mobilizing people to stand up and refuse to accept horrors like killer cops getting away again and again and again. That's a part of mobilizing and preparing for revolution. I got one more thing I got to say, because my man Muhammad Ali died last week. This man meant a whole lot to me. He refused to go to Vietnam. He refused to go in the army in 1967 because he said, I ain't gonna go fight no Vietnamese people. They not my enemy. My enemy is right here. My fight is right here. A couple years after he did that, I got drafted into the army and they gave me orders to go to Vietnam. I said, ain't no black man got any good reason to go to Vietnam to kill Asian people for this system. If I got to fight, I got to fight here. They threw me in jail for doing that in the military penitentiary, but that's what led to me becoming a revolutionary. So I really love Ali and I embrace his legacy from that point. But look, all these people went on TV, Bill Clinton, all these other people talking about they love Ali. They embrace his legacy. Well, I got a question for all of these people. If Ali put it all on the line to resist the injustices coming down on black people then, and you embrace his legacy, what are you doing about the injustices being put down on black people today? And if you ain't doing nothing, take Muhammad Ali out of your mouth. Because you ain't got no right to talk about that man, because that's what he was inspiring about. And if you ain't ready to do that, stop talking about you love Ali and his legacy. So, look, I'm going to grind this down pretty quickly. These cops murdered Freddie Gray. This system is letting them go on the installment plan, one by one by one. That is unacceptable. It's got to stop. And it's really up to us to stand up and say it's got to stop and act to stop it. I'm going to stop right there. We got some other folks that's going to talk. We'll start next with Tawanda Jones. And she don't need no introduction, but I'm going to give her one.
That was Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network speaking at a Baltimore press conference in front of the courthouse where Cesar Goodson, the cop who subjected Freddie Gray to a rough ride over a year ago, is on trial for murder. So that was recorded last week by the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. You have been listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CQT 90.3 FM. Stay tuned for Butcher T's Noontime Cuts. I'm going to leave you with Kalfani Malik Khaldun, who reads and comments on Affirmation by Asata Shakur.
Hello, this is Brother Kalfani Malik Khaldun calling in from Indiana. Affirmation: I believe in living. I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people. I believe in sunshine and windmills and waterfalls, tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees. I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes. I believe in the rain and the tears and the blood of infinity. I believe in life, and I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth, sculpting mud bodies in its path. I have seen the destruction of the daylight and seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind and the blind become the blind. In one easy lesson, I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blundered bread and breathed the stench of indifference. I have been locked by the lawless, handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy, and if I know anything at all, it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all. It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth. I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship steered by tired seasick sailors can still be guided home to port. That is the end of the poem, but I would also like to say that these are the words of Asata, and I believe that these are the words of freedom, speaking to the world to touch the hearts and minds of every revolutionary spirit that exists in society. These words are for those of us who cannot speak, the voice of the voiceless. These words are also memories of those that we have lost, the spirits that have been broken, those that have been chained by those who abuse authority. And these are the words of the freedom fighter who sits in Cuba in exile. And these are the words of the political prisoners, those who are struggling and those who are continuing to fight. Uhuru Sasa, those are the words of Asata Shakur, and the continuation of my opinion of what those words meant to me. Peace and love to all that continue to strive for freedom.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thank you for listening to